What were you going to say?
I had an experience coming out here very similar. I got pulled over for speeding in Texas. And he asked me, he said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Sedona, Arizona." He said, "Why are you going there?" You know, I have long hair, right? And I said, "To study with Dr. Hawkins." And so he goes, "What does he teach?" And I go, "Consciousness, human consciousness." And he goes, "You know what? I'm just going to get you a warning. You go ahead, okay?"
Oh, golly.
Wait a second. He's not done.
Oh.
He asked one more question. He came back to the window and go, "Here," and just walked off. He didn't want
to. Because you're a space case, you don't want to get involved, huh? Consciousness sounds like woo woo woo. Oh, I see. Yeah, yes. Yeah, you're pulling in the energy. Yeah, right. Okay.
This may not work every time.
Well, the energy is one of loving him for what he's doing and being dutiful. You know, see, I respect them. And when a policeman pulls me over, I always respect the fact that he's doing what he is trained and knows he should do. So he's being integrous. So I respect his integrity. That's right. So you respect their integrity, and so as you respect their integrity, they get their being respected. And don't forget, most of the so-called negative experiences people have with policemen are provoked. You know, you push the cop to the point that he's past his self-control, so now he can be the bad guy. So this is a trick of the lower energy fields, is to provoke that which is integrous until it blows its integrity. You see if you can get them to blow it. So it's always beneficial to give the policeman the respect that is due his office. You don't have to get personal about it, the same as the President of the United States. The presidency itself is worthy of respect. And so attacking the person or attacking the office, you have to be clear which you're talking about. And sometimes political cartoonists, I think, are incorrect because they're actually attacking the office, which in a time of war is not really integrous. Once you protect the office, and still you can differ with the person who holds the office, but the office itself, after all, you're looking to the government of the United States to save your life and provide for your old age and God knows what all. Give you Medicare when you get old. And all. You're expecting a lot from the government. So you should give it a little something in return besides just taxes. So what we hold integrously tends to become that. So when we say to the policeman, I know you're doing what you're supposed to do, and I respect you for that, you know, he appreciates that. And, okay. What is the difference between love and joy? Well, love, as we said, takes many expressions. Many people are here out of the energy field of love, and what they do is energized by love. Joy is a different state. Joy goes beyond love and lovingness. Love and lovingness you can live with all the time. It's sort of an evenness that lights up everything. Joy is more intense. Joy is more exuberant, you might say. Its energy is more, it sort of swamps you. Joy sort of takes you over. One can be prone to joy, without being in that state all the time. You can go from lovingness, unconditional lovingness, into joy, into ecstasy. We got ecstasy up there? No. Okay. Anyway, you can, as you ascend the scale, you reach sort of sublime states, sort of states that are really sort of sublime. The ecstasy is beyond description and hard to handle if you're around people. One time I went to a state of ecstasy, and there's a chapel over here, the chapel of something or other. Huh? Yeah. At 1 o'clock in the morning, nobody was there. The candles were all lit. And there was this beautiful music playing. And ecstasy reached such a state that the body began to dance with ecstasy. I was a pretty good dancer. And it was the only possible way to handle it was to give it physical expression. One sort of dance was danced by the ecstasy of the glory of God as revealed to your own awareness. Ecstatic, ecstatic. And so one did that to express to God one's joy and appreciation for divinity. One's the joy is that one has been allowed to experience the quality of divinity experientially within one's own capacity to experience. So the joy is almost like an exquisite thankfulness that one has been allowed to experience the presence, and one wishes to reflect back the thankfulness and the joy at the revelation in whatever manner you're able to express it. It says joy is higher on the scale. Oh yeah, it is, right? So the only way you can escape joy, beyond joy is ecstasy. And here is an ecstatic state. I understood what Ramakrishna went into. Ramakrishna described the exact state, and he would go into ecstatic states. So the ecstatic is beyond joy. Ecstatic, under recalibrated. Let's see where ecstatic, can we recalibrate ecstatic? Ecstatic spiritual ecstasy is beyond 540, 560, 580, 585, 590, 590. Spiritual ecstasy is exquisite. And then just beyond that, as I said earlier in the lecture, just beyond that ecstatic state, if you surrender the ecstasy to God, then the infinite peace of God comes. That is beyond all. However, I wouldn't miss the joy and the ecstasy on the way. it's rather profound. It gives you a certain, you see, the other thing that happens in certain states is you get to know who else is there, or who else has been there, you might say. You get to experience the presence of a rarefied strata, and those who have been there, how can we say it? It's outside of time. It's like they're still there. It's like a shared experience because you've transcended temporality. So to go into the same state as Christ went into, or Ramakrishna or any of the great saints, it's like you share the experience with them. It's hard to explain, but there's a commonality of experience in which your consciousness and their consciousness are actually one and the same. So in that state, one experiences Ramakrishna's ecstasy because his ecstasy and yours are not different. It's all the same. And there's a point I call the high pass where you get hit by the luciferic temptation. And all power is yours. Now that you're beyond karma, now that you're beyond, you don't have to answer to anything or anyone, now that you realize there's no adversarial God who will punish you for anything, and now that you're beyond personal karma, all power is yours. Own it. All power is yours. And in that state, you saw exactly who went through and what they said. It's a very high test, and it's very subtly expressed by the luciferic energy out of which it arises. And you realize that Jesus Christ said no to it. And you see who else said no to it. Because the falsehood is, yes, you're beyond personal karma. I mean, this presentation is not verbalized, it's a knowingness. It's a knowingness. And this knowingness comes as a profound temptation. And what was I going to say about it? Oh, yes. The error is, yes, you're beyond personal karma, but you're not beyond the karma of the infinite presence of God, whose context is inclusive of all that exists. You're beyond your personal karma, but you're not beyond the karma of God being the infinite context out of which all arises. So you're not beyond the karmic realm of God. You're beyond personal karma, but you're not beyond the karma of the universe. So if you make that mistake, you end up along with Lucifer and his club there, Lucifer Club. I already answered the next question. It says, as you begin reaching higher states, you become a more favorable game for the lower astral. You become juicier and a nicer plum to haul home. So you see a lot of gurus that write books that are quite well known. They're still, everybody lights candles to them and all, and they were in the 500s when they wrote it, but they have gone way down since. What do the astral beings get out of that? They get pulling that which they hate and that which is out of which they are jealous back down. So it's like crabs. They say when you put a bunch of crabs in a pail, as one crab starts to get out, the other crabs will pull them back down into the pail. It's for the same reason that anybody who's successful, rich, powerful, etc., becomes fair target. It's discrimination is politically incorrect unless you're successful, in which case discrimination and assault and attack and blackmail and everything else can be thrown at you because you're rich and powerful, right? Same laws don't apply now. So it would be out of jealousy. So it's jealousy and hatred. That's the motivation here is jealousy and hatred resist. You know. It's jealousy and hatred, see? Don't forget that the lower astral realm gains by, the more evil they are, the more they rank. The game of dungeons and what is it, somethings and dungeons?
Huh?
Yeah, doesn't dragons and dungeons pretty well delineate the lower astral? It's even got the correct esoteric terminology, the names for them. So, you know, you're a made guy when you murder somebody in front of a witness. Now you rank higher in the mafia, correct? You're just riffraff down there if you just rob banks and steal from honest people, steal cars and all. You're just punks. No, you're nobody at all until you are witnessed. So somebody can attest to the fact they saw you murder somebody in cold blood. Now you got rank. So it's the rank of better and better and better. So the higher the captive you can pull in, he now becomes your servant and your vassal. So you gain power by proselytizing and pulling people into your ranks. I believe that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about, resist. That's all it's about. It's just the gamemanship of who can be the most evil and therefore rank the highest. You know, history shows some profound examples we've seen on television. The Japanese, after the Japanese in Nanking, I think it was a Vietnamese soldier bayoneting the infant in the arms of its mother, took on a new rank, the ultimate cruelty, hardness, the surrendering to the ultimate, and that's how you gain rank there in the lower astral. And when you get there, you find there's people that are far more wicked than you are, and you're not at the top, you're at the bottom, baby. And when we tell you what you got to do to get fired up the ranks. Oh, boy. So you just don't want to go there. So the lower astral is to keep us from being focused on enlightenment. And they do represent the temptations of the satanic and the luciferic. All right, so we answered those pretty well. And those are things we've also written about to make sure people comprehend it. Everybody talks, you know, there tends to be a goody-goodiness about spirituality sometimes that is a form of denial, because the spiritual aspirant is also a fair target for that which would like to bring it down. And I think every spiritual student should be forewarned that that which is non-integrous will certainly seek to pull you out of the game, certainly seek to pull you out of the game by one temptation or another. This one, I don't understand the question. Yeah?
Did you want to take questions from the audience?
Okay. Is it best to avoid people who are spiritually below integrity? That's what all the spiritual teachers, including the great Christian saints, said, to not hang out with such people. Because they have sort of a collective karma, and just the fact that you're there begins to attract things to it. That's sort of the broken window principle, you know, which sociology has discovered. The broken window, you see, this takes us beyond causality. What attracts negativity is the field, see? It's not sequential causation. It isn't that the broken window causes something. The negative energy which is focused there, the attractor energy field which is focused there, brings upon itself the broken window, which again brings upon itself the drug addict, which again brings itself upon itself the rape, which again brings upon itself the abandoned baby, and those addicted to crime. And it shows up, of course, initially with graffiti and broken windows and trash on the streets. But you see, it's not causal. It's not that the broken window causes the rape, or that the rape causes the crime, or that the crime causes the drugs. And then the gangs get into turf war over who owns the building. And I remember the last time I saw Brownsville or the lower Bronx, the South Bronx, it was unbelievable. It's like you say, this can't be. You drive through the street, and you see where the smoke has come out of all these buildings have been set on fire. And you see where the smoke came out from the window and the side of the windows. The side of the buildings are all black, and they're covered with graffiti. The streets are covered with filth. People are falling over with drunkenness and alcohol and drugs and prostitution openly on the street. And mugging will take place right in front of your eyes. They don't even give a damn if you watch. They just mug somebody right in front of your eyes. You say, I got to be making this up, you know what I mean? But it's like that energy field is pulling to itself. So you see a lifetime where a person is born in a very low energy field. They're born into that kind of a neighborhood, to that kind of parents, and unless their energy field changes, awful things will be happening to them throughout their lifetime. So they're born into a miserable condition here, and now they're in juvenile jail here, and they've got multiple misdemeanors, and then that usually graduates to a felony. So when we see a person arrested, let's say everybody gets sad about and politically correct about three times and out in California, you know, and they have some guy, he's put away for life now for stealing a pizza. I tell you, he ain't being put away for a pizza. This guy's criminal background goes back to age 6. He's got probably 49 misdemeanors. He's got 23 felonies that nobody detected yet. Two times in prison, you know the third time's going to put you out and you still steal a pizza. It means there's something missing in your frontal cortex, doesn't it? It means you're not very well anchored in reality. It means you can't control your own impulses. No, you've got a disease called criminality that compulsively you're going to keep on doing it because you can't learn from experience, because you're not afraid of consequences, because you can't control your own impulses, because this has been a lifetime lifestyle. So, like the pedophiles I've treated, you know, I only got busted, you know, one time. And then in therapy, you find out he's molested over 100 kids. This is probably the average pedophile that I treated had probably molested at least 50 or 60 to 100 kids before he was arrested. So he's not being arrested for this incident. He's got a record going back this time. He just got caught this time. So you have to have the whole picture, the whole context. So as we said, the lie is composed of taking content out of context. And one thing you'll see that the media does all the time is warp reality by not telling you what the context was. You got busted for a pizza, and what else? And he's stolen thousands of things, literally going back over his entire lifetime. A chronic thief. How many things do you think he's stolen before he's finally arrested? Hundreds and hundreds. The rapist, how many times have they raped? Dozens of times. The pedophile, 50, 100 times. So they're not going to jail for stealing this pizza at all. What's the answer? I don't know what the answer is. To keep them isolated from vulnerable people, as far as I know. I don't know what else to do about them. It seems to be an incurable addiction. And I think it comes from the lower astral. These are lower astrals that have somehow gotten into physical bodies. That's a fact, yeah. Because they have no spiritual inclination and no capacity for honesty. Okay. This is traveling through astral realms, which I don't recommend. When did Mother Teresa reach her state of bliss? Early in life or late in life? I don't know. Did she ever write an autobiography or anything biographical? Mother Teresa?
Yeah, she did.
Did she? I don't know what she says in there about when she reached that state. Huh?
She doesn't talk about it.
Oh, she doesn't talk about it. Well, we calibrated, you know, that her heart is extremely high. Her heart was like 700. Mother Teresa's heart was like 700. It came about as a result of Christian devotion. Unswervingly. Unswerving devotion to God. And there's a question about avoidance. And see, the ultimate state is neither attraction nor aversion. So one surrenders aversions and asks to see it differently, the same as you do with attachments. To have an aversion to something is like the reverse of an attachment. So the ultimate state is non-attached. It means you don't have to be detached. You don't have to avoid it. It's okay if it is and okay if it isn't. Now that isn't as hard to reach as you think it is, you see. This neutrality is a pretty released state. There's a teaching which arose in Sedona, or it was actually in New York, teaching how to get to neutrality. Letting go, wanting to change things, control them, make them different, wanting anything from other people. And it takes you right through neutrality. You know, if you get the job, it's great, and if you don't, you'll find one elsewhere. So it's a state of freedom. And originally when I learned the technique, it was back east in New York, and it was called freedom. And it had to do with letting go attachments and aversions. By letting go, wanting to change them in yourself or out in the world. And if you continuously do that, you become quite detached. You know, it's true, you do become quite unattached. So all the things that you learn at levels, you know, it isn't that 500 is better than 200, it's not better than, it's just you're in a different space. Like being in a different place on the map. Your problem to get from here to there is different if you start out from Albuquerque or you start out from Denver. You're just in a different place, and therefore you're looking at different lessons. But you can go from one level quickly all the way up to the... So you can't say, well, because you're at 200 this week, you can't be at 500 next week. You can be at 500 on the way home in the car. Suddenly, like a flash, you just let because whatever's blocking it, the minute you let it go, then you open for the light to come in, and the light comes right in. So how come a person can go from a really great state to a lousy state very quickly in a matter of seconds? That's called being human, huh? It's called being at the effect of being a human and having a human brain. And the human brain, as it's constructed, you understand, is an add-on. The prefrontal cortex, that which makes us human, is an add-on to the old animal brain. The reptilian brain is still there. All the basic primitive brains all throughout the eons from 400 million years ago is still there and still operative. And, you know, by choice, you can become an instant killer. The old dragon is still there. And we've learned not to respond to it. But that impulse to kill still comes up, doesn't it? It comes out of the old amygdala or wherever the hell it is. Yeah. Like the, what's that dragon that one bite and you're dead? something or other dragon.
Komodo
dragon, yeah. We have permission to calibrate his energy. Let's see. Komodo dragon. It's okay to calibrate his energy. It's over 20, 25, 30, 40, 45, about 45. You get bitten by something that's at 45, you wish you hadn't. Imagine this guy, he was a friend of a movie star or something, he goes into the cage with the Komodo dragon. Oh my God, I think with no boots on or something. Anyway, and he's still alive. So it's possible for a person to do kinesiology with a reasonable degree of accuracy by oneself. See, one thing about kinesiology is you can, by asking a question in many different ways, if you're doubtful about a question, if this is so, then that over there must be so. So if you ask them independently, you'll get corroboration. So if I was questioning the level that I got on the Komodo dragon, I would utilize other things that I know about reptilian life and primitive life and primordial life and contextualize it now within a whole field of data. Then if it didn't fit the data, I would have to go back in and find out why that is so. What do we say the Komodo dragon calibrated at? 45. So he's worse than Tyrannosaurus Rex, huh?
No, I think Rex is at
70. We can do Tyrannosaurus Rex. He's over 65. He's over 70, 75. Tyrannosaurus Rex is at 70. And the Komodo dragon's at what?
45.
All right. Well, I mean, it's just a curiosity, you know, how do all those creatures line up? I don't want to meet one in the dark, do you? The ego isn't real, is it? That's correct. It's not a reality any more than is mind. Both mind and ego are general terms. The only trouble with using general terms is people believe if a thing has a name, it must have an existence in reality. That's how a great deal of illusion arises. If we have a name for something, then it must be real. A lot of names are merely tautologies. In other words, it means what you define it to mean. And by common usage, it gains ground, and pretty soon the mind begins to think it's a reality. The belief in causality is the most serious error in that regard. You see, because sequentially one thing follows another, we now impute from imagination something mysterious within the world called causality. Well, if you dissect all these things here, you show me causality, you won't find any, because there ain't no causality there. The causality is within the belief system of the observer. It has no objective independent existence. This is demonstrated mathematically, of course, in quantum mathematics, quantum mechanics. where you find, what you find is what you look for. What you discover is based on intention. Whatever your intention is what you're going to come up with, because you just defined it. By defining it, you're obviously going to select what you've already defined. So in other words, a pseudo-objectivity tends to reify itself. You know what reify means? To re-constantly, in a feedback, reinforce itself, because you believe in the reality of something that exists only in mind. When you look out there, you think you get verification of its existence, which in, so you get an amplification, a self-feedback amplification of non-reality, which makes the so-called ego difficult to overcome. Everyone is convinced that behind one's actions, there is a self, an I, answerable, punishable, who is the source and the origin, and the little homunculus within your brain that makes decisions. Everyone's at the effect of that. Okay. In doing the chapters for the book, for instance, I thought this is probably the last book I'm going to write of this genre, so I wanted to make sure it was, you know, correct in every detail. So we calibrated every chapter, and if a chapter came out less than 990, there were a couple of chapters that were only like 987. Most of them are like 990. Most of them are on 9. The book is 999.6 right now, but anyway, we got 996 is all right, but some came out in the 980s. And I said, no, there's an error in here. And what is the error? So I went back over the chapter, and in myself, I'm looking at what could be the error, and all of a sudden I saw it. The word ego and the word mind, because that supports the illusion that they have an independent reality, that there is such a thing as ego, whereas in reality there isn't. So when I changed the word ego to thinkingness, the chapter would jump from 987 to 992 or something. Just so supporting the illusion that there is such a thing as ego or mind was bringing down the calibration. So I changed the term ego to thinkingness, the habit of thinkingness, and with that, the chapter jumped way up. So I was, you know, from the level of truth, the chapter was being penalized by reinforcing the illusion that there is a thing called ego and a thing called mind. Thinkingness goes on of its own, because that's the nature of thinkingness. There's no I doing that thinking. And if you tell yourself to stop thinking, you'll see instantly you can't stop thinking. And if you were that which is thinking, it would stop the minute you told it to. But it, obviously, it's independent of you and doesn't care what you think. Tell the mind stop thinking. Yeah, right. Stop thinking. You kidding? The mind thinks that's a joke. Thinkingness is what it does. You're asking it to not be what it is. See, so its function is all it is. It isn't a noun. It's a function. Thinkingness happens of its own, spontaneously. And as you become aware of that, in the meditative techniques which I describe, you become, one of the first things you become aware of is that thinkingness is happening of its own. It's an independent, impersonal quality which you've inherited, and it is not you in the first place. So that's part of the disidentification with the physicality of the body as you. As you lose various parts of your body, you still say, I. They take off one leg, you still say I. They take off another leg, you still say I. You take off another, take off your arm, you still say I. You take off another arm, you still say I. I mean, if you were the body, you'd be getting to be less and less I. So obviously you're not the body. I lost my thumb and I'm still the same people, myself, right? So obviously, so first you transcend the physicality of identification with the physicality called body, and you realize I am not the body, you know, I have a body. Then you proceed to do the same thing with mind. Thinkingness goes on, but I am not thinkingness, nor am I the quality of thinkingness, nor am I the content of thinkingness. Thinkingness is happening spontaneously. The physicality is doing what it's doing spontaneously. there's an illusion that there's an I causing it to do what it's doing. I don't know, this leg crossed this leg. I didn't ask it to. I don't make any decision about it. I didn't say, hey, left leg cross right leg. If I ask what's the body doing, I notice it's there. I don't remember making a decision to cross my legs, do you? Does anybody remember making a decision to be where you are? Did you? Look how you're sitting. Did you make a decision? You did not. It happened all by itself. Everyone is just being what you spontaneously are. Nobody's making a decision to do what you're doing. Breathing and sitting there and crossing, and all this is all coming out of physicality because that's what physicality does. So to, you know, remove the pronoun I as a causal agent behind everything that you witness and experience is one of the things that you surrender. And one easy way to do it is to say that the illusion that there is an I doing this is a vanity. And if you're committed to experiencing the presence of the love of God, one of the vanities you have to let go of is that there is this primordial, wonderful thing called I that's causing anything. First of all, there is no such thing as causality. That's all illusion. And secondly, there is no I behind it. So that's the ultimate illusion that you let go of. And as you let go of that, suddenly you go up to a very ecstatic state because you're free. So there's a profound sense of freedom. There isn't any I causing anything. There isn't any consequence to anything because there isn't any I to suffer a consequence. As I say, that's the opening through which the luciferic tries to trick you. So the question was, the ego isn't real. That's correct. The ego isn't real. I think thinking this goes on, and then if you want to put all these thoughts together with a descriptive term, you call it mind. The habitual positionalities that mind takes, we collectively term ego. So ego is then just a descriptive convenience. So in the beginning, I removed the word ego a lot and put thinkingness in. And then I went back and I decided I can't remove all of the references to it, so I'll define what is meant by the term ego and remove the illusion that it's an actual it that you have to fight, survive, transcend, etc. So ego is a useful term up to a certain level. Then it's an illusion you have to let go of. It's okay. So many things that are not basically true from an absolute extremely high state are okay to hang out with until you get to a certain point, and then they've served their purpose and you don't need them anymore. Thinking this goes on by itself. You don't have to call it anything at all, except to realize it's not you. You surrender it as it happens. Is it possible to reach a really high state and still live and serve in the world? I think that's up to karmic propensity. I think there's a karmic propensity. I think, let's ask, this is up to a karmic propensity resist. This is actually even up to a contract resist, an agreement, a celestial agreement resist. Oh, wow. Yes, there seems to be an agreement because we know statistically that most people, when they hit 600, quit. Most people are 600, bliss out, that's the end. And I say they may smile sweetly as people go by, but they're not going to be teaching school or doing anything effective in the world because you cannot really function at 600. As you go into a state of profound bliss, there's no desire to be anything else, no desire to change anything, there's nothing left unfinished. There's nothing that says to you there's more. There isn't any more, because the state is complete and total in and of itself. And you can sit on a rock and not eat and not drink and not go to the bathroom or not anything. And whether the body survives or the breathing continues is totally irrelevant and not even interesting. And people want you to do this and that. Well, if you love them, you do it to make them happy. But it's totally irrelevant whether this physicality continues. So many people very few people who go into extremely high states manage to re-enter the world, much less function in the world. And we did a statistical study, I forget what the figures are, in the book, but the higher one goes, the less likely, at extremely high levels, the chances are practically zero that a person will function in the world again. Up to 600 is blissful and exquisite, and beyond that, up to 700 is beautiful. And beyond that, it is difficult and frequently painful. And it's like one is driven by some inner knowingness, not really driven, one is attracted, energized. It's as though the context of the infinite reality is intolerant of something that detains it from the full expression of its infinite allness. It's like that. Is that correct? That's correct. Okay. Now, this happens itself rather infrequently. Most times, you get into a state of bliss, and that's it. And there's no necessity to go beyond it. There's absolutely no necessity to go beyond it. Nor is there any drivenness to go on beyond it. Nor is there any attraction. It just begins to happen of its own. So all these things are happening of their own. Even spiritual work itself, one can either take credit or for doing it or not. What's happened is that one is being attracted. One is being attracted by the goal. You say, you know, it's not a drivenness. It's not a, from a backwards to forwards. It's from the future motivating you in the present, which in a linear Newtonian sense makes no sense. But from the viewpoint of quantum mechanics, the present can be, we'll say this, the backwards consequence of the future. That which is infinitely the potential in the future is already the past in the present from this paradigm. So one is really being potentiated in the present by the future, which is already past, you might say. Let's see, we're not saying that right, are we?
Reincarnated from the future.
No, it's not a reincarnation. It's, we would have to go into some advanced mathematics of quantum mechanics, but it's because past and present and future, you see, are all positionalities. Once you transcend positionalities, that which from this paradigm would seem like the future is no longer the future. So one is energized in the present by that which has already happened in the future. Does that make sense? Any of you understand quantum mechanics? Is that correct? Yes. So you're potentiated then in the present by that which has already happened in the future, so that one can rest assured that one's enlightenment is a certainty, or you wouldn't be attracted to this kind of material. You'd say, it doesn't make any sense, it's kooky, and we ought to have him arrested and examined by a doctor or something. Yes, we'll take questions from the audience. So can one reach that state and still serve in the world? Well, those are all paradoxes of what do you mean by the world and what do you mean serve. One is what they are. See, the bird is what it is as it flies through the air. You, to say it's doing something from the world, you see, is a projection. It is what it is in the context of the allness of creation, as creation unfolds itself at this moment. So it fulfills that niche in the cosmic allness. Huh? Is it doing something for the world? Well, it might make a child happy, but it's not because the child is being caused to be happy by the bird. But the child's happiness, I'm sure, is energizing the field, which is attracting the bird, and he just happens to fly over you. And it seems accidental, whereas actually everything that is witnessed is happening in concert as the unfolding of the energy field of consciousness. And as you're aware of that, that's called revelation, you know, that things are unfolding as the fulfillment of their potentiality as they are created out of the infinite presence of God. See? So God manifests as all with that which is, and there isn't any person or self fulfilling that. So if you're supposed to dig ditches, you dig ditches. If you're supposed to teach, you're supposed to carve, whatever it is that you're meant to do. At a certain level, one may do nothing, but that is already serving a great matter of service, because how many people are willing to sit and do nothing? If it would serve the world, how many people would volunteer to do nothing? You volunteer to do nothing? Fantastic. Well, we'll turn you into a saint for sure. The saint of bliss. You just sit there and smiles, and people light incense and get into a high state and feel terrific. So that is of service, you see. But again, you see, these are all projections. So do we have any more questions from the audience? I want to make sure we've covered all the subjects sufficiently that we've handled it. Yes?
Our friend handed us a book in a bag and asked us to calibrate it. And we didn't know what the book was, and we calibrated it. And we got over 980. Mm-hmm. And he told us that you had just calibrated the book and got 280. Did we pick up on your energy? Is that
I don't know. We'd have to ask. Let's ask about this book. We have permission to ask about this book. We have permission to ask about the book to which she's referring. Resist. No, I don't know why. I don't know why. You don't always get the answer that you expect, you know? Let's see. We have permission to follow up her question, Resist. All right. She's asking about, she's asking about the accuracy of her own kinesiology, Resist. Her own calibration came out too high, Resist. I see what it was. She wasn't using the scale as a point of reference, Resist. Okay. All right. One other point of accuracy in kinesiology. When you calibrate a number. See, yes or no, there's usually not too many mistakes if you know the technique. Yes and no is usually correct. When you start calibrating numbers, you have to designate. On this scale of consciousness of 1 to 1,000, where 600 is enlightenment, in reference to this scale, this book calibrates over such and such. If you just do it wildly with no point of reference, we get letters from people that say they calibrated their 5-year-old who's over 2,000. Well, that kid would be an ember by now if it's over 2,000. Fried on the spot. So in this book, we put a reminder, I think we did in Eye of the Eye, in reference to this scale of consciousness where, you know, you can designate it anyway. 200 is courage and 600 is peace or whatever. In reference to this particular scale, then this calibrates over so-and-so, over so-and-so, over so-and-so. That way you'll get an accurate answer. Don't forget, this is an arbitrary scale. So if you don't designate a specific scale, you can get any kind of a number. See, we could have, instead of 1 to 1,000, we could have gone from 100 to 10,000. We could have gone from 1 to 100. You understand what I'm saying? We could have gone from 1 to 10. We could have gone, we could make this up here 1, and this would be 0.9, 0.8, 0.7. You understand? So the scale, the dimension mathematically is arbitrary. You can make up your own scale. You can make up your own scale. This one just happens to be handy because it's been worked over by lots of people over many years. And the answers are pretty well known. These have been pretty well checked by zillions of people in Doubting Thomases. If you make up your own scale, you can get the same kind of accuracy. So you can make this 1, 2, 3, 4. So on a scale of 1 to 10, then this would calibrate at, 3.2 or something. You know what I'm saying? So anybody can make up your own scale. It's accurate only in the context of itself, but you can make up any scale. It's internally consistent. So what you want by any scale is internal consistency. It's the same with the Fahrenheit scale or the centigrade scale. You can make up your own scale of temperature, And as long as it's internally consistent, it will be useful. So any scientific scale very often has no existence, objective existence in reality. It's merely an arbitrary indentation, and it serves a pragmatic value. So this is a pragmatic value. You want to get the feeling of where things are in relationship to each other. And the number itself, there's nothing particularly magical about the number. It was useful, for instance, in calibrating a chapter. If it's 987, I say to myself, well, what's wrong with it? You know, where is the error? So it's practically useful and it's internally consistent. So that's the answer, is you may have to make reference to a specific scale, and then you'll probably get the same number as everybody else. Anybody got any other questions? Go ahead.
Could you say a little more about spiritual wealth?
What did you say?
Spiritual wealth.
What?
I want you to reiterate about spiritual wealth.
I don't know what that is.
What's that?
Or did he say will? W-I-L-L? Oh, yes. When we talked about meditation, we said that... Spiritual
wealth, too.
Spiritual wealth, yeah. That's good karma. Your good karma bank account. As you check out of each lifetime, you make sure that one of the angels checks out all your good karma. I left with 10,000 good karmas in there. He only got me down for $9.98. How about that old lady I helped across the street? Okay. Yeah. Spiritual will is really the seat from which one makes spiritual progress. It's really the seat from which one becomes the meditator. In the chapter on meditation, in the books, in the lecture on meditation, spiritual will, because it's not fluctuating all the time. See, if you try to come from emotion, emotions are constantly changing. If you try to come from ideas, if you try to come from the content of mind, you're going to have a heck of a time. If you look at the content of mind, it's a phantasmagoria with no beginning and ending. It goes from memories into imaginations, into fears, into emotions, into inventions, and it goes diddy diddy boop boop, and you know what your mind does when you're driving down the street, bum diddy bum bum, biddy biddy boop boop. I mean, how can you handle that? You can't handle it. So you can't handle it from the viewpoint of content. You can handle it from the viewpoint of intention, because intention doesn't waver. See, the content of the mind is constantly jiggling around like this, and the content of feelings. You feel good, you feel happy, you feel bad, you feel disappointed, you feel fearful. Uh-oh, then comes a car from the left-hand side, and you got to quick change your plan. So you can't deal with the content of mind. You can't deal with mind by looking at the content. And many people who follow various meditative pathways get nowhere with it because they're trying to constantly correct and surrender content. You can't. It creates itself faster than you can surrender it. You can't surrender as fast as the mind will create it. Besides, whatever you let go of, it creates a vacuum, and the mind will come in there with three thoughts for every one that you let go of. The one thing that does not fluctuate is spiritual intention and the spiritual will. So what sets karma, is the spiritual will. What one is karmically answerable for, spiritually answerable for, that which determines one's level of consciousness, is the commitment of the spiritual will. That does not change, usually doesn't change. When it makes a major change, though, that means you're going to have a major change in your life. So people will lead a very low-level kind of a life and then suddenly become spiritually inspired. Now their spiritual commitment is totally different. People become saints in prisons, you know, not uncommon for a person who goes in as a chronic criminal to suddenly go through a transformation and become a very integrous and almost enlightened being. So a shift to spiritual will is what really changes the karmic balance, because to that you can commit. You can commit to the willingness to dedicate your life to God and to surrender all impediments as they arise. That doesn't change. So you don't have to keep switching around your intention and asking yourself questions. You know what your commitment is. You can revise it and re-examine it. And at times you'll question it. Am I really willing to go to the extremes that this seems to require? And then you'll have to answer it again. sometimes just clarifying with what is sourcing that question will answer the question, and then spiritual progress resumes. So spiritual will, then, is very important, and I'm glad it was brought up, although we may have mentioned it before. It requires re-emphasis. It's spiritual will that sets the karmic balance. See, people say, how do these things arise? These are all the way your spiritual will sets itself. These are what decisions your spiritual will has made that determines all this. If you determine I'm going to be unconditionally loving no matter what, then you set this as your goal. That becomes your commitment. Anything less than that now becomes painful. So when you're down here in anger, cursing out a driver who jumps in front of you is fun. I mean, it's okay. There's nothing wrong with it. And up here, you even feel good about it, see? But when you get up to this state, this is no longer going to be acceptable. So the only trouble with moving up the marker on your spiritual will is that everything below it is now going to become uncomfortable, no longer acceptable, and painful. Down here, angriness, see, from here, angriness feels good. That's why a lot of people like anger. It gives them a temporary feeling of power. It's better than apathy. It's better than fear. Eh? So it's a jump up from fear to anger. They're not willing to let go of their angriness because then they sink back into apathy and fear. So from here, anger feels like moving up. But from here, anger is moving down. So you see, where you set your spiritual marker is going to define what you feel as pleasurable. It's going to define your perception of what's good, what's bad, what's desirable, what's not desirable. So that spiritual marker, you know, like setting the whatever it is and what that game is, you set what your goal is. Now everything below that you lose and everything above that you win. Huh? I'm sure there's a game somewhere that does that. Yeah.
If we're thinking that we're at the level of reason, and we justify anger.
Right? Well, you're pulling in certain levels at the service of others. This is getting a little more subtle and sophisticated. But if you're committed here, then you'll subvert reason to serve the angriness to justify yourself. So this is rationalization. Your predominant level is really anger. And this is your reason that then becomes the clever source of your excuse. Well, it's because he did so-and-so, I'm justified in so-and-so. And he was wrong, and I was right. So you want to justify the anger. So these various levels will serve the predominant level. Seeing as most of America is set here in reason, to appeal to things, you got to be logical. So President Bush is called upon by the Democrats and the Congress to present a logical, concrete facts that would justify any kind of action. Just fear of attack from others isn't enough. Just anger at him is not enough. Just moralistic positionality about them is not enough. We got to have some kind of concrete facts. So America is pretty much run by, you know, officially run by reason. Of course, then everybody distorts reason into emotionality and take things out of context and distort the truth. So each side tries to win then by distorting the truth or editing it in their own favor. The group started today over 4:35. Let's see. We have permission to ask about the group. Before we started the lecture today, they were over 4:35, 4:36. They were at 4. Before we started at 4:36, 4:37. Okay. Okay. The group after the end of the lecture today went up over 4 points, 5 points, 6 points, 7 points, 8 points, 7 points. The group went up today 7 points, 8 points, 7 points. Some points. The average lifetime is 5 points, so you went up over one lifetime just in the day today. It isn't, you know, it isn't just a calibrated level, you see, because we're looking at a certain fallacy of logic, see? It would seem like moving from a certain point to a certain point, we're superimposing an artificiality, see? to eliminate through a subtle understanding a source of something that's been painful all your life. The payoff is enormous. You understand what I'm saying? Even the most subtle shift of awareness about something, now it no longer has the power to injure you or harm you or aggravate you or make you think about suicide. Now it's a joke. The difference between tragedy and a joke makes all the difference in the world. All right, so recontextualizing things may only calibrate numerically at a certain time, but those are germinal ideas. Those are germinal ideas. So one germinal idea may only calibrate, you know, change your calibration 1 point, but then because it's been planted, now it's going to transform of its own nature because your intention is superimposed upon it. So your intention will be more important than whether you went up a few points or something like that. What you do with it, how you valuable it, and where it grows from there. So these things become germinated, and then you all have had the experience. You're driving down the road, and all of a sudden you get a complete understanding of something you've heard for years, and suddenly you get it. You know, that's a joyful moment. It's like whatever was blocking that awareness is removed now. Certain spiritual information is in and of itself transformational. Okay, let's see that. Certain seminal information, certain critical information is in and of itself transformational resistant. Some of what was said today is transformational resistant. Okay. So in other words, all we did, we saw how it shifted the blocks, but then that's going to continue and bring a cascade. So that's a lot to assimilate. It can also be upsetting to try to assimilate too much too fast. In a way, you have to like grow with it and let it sort of settle, and then you're ready to move on to the next point, and then you're ready to move on to the next point. If you jerk somebody right out of one of these patterns here and throw them into another one, it can be very disruptive, very disruptive. So each person grows then at the rate of their own capacity, their own intention, their own readiness, their own karmic ripeness. And each of us evolves at a specific rate. And you don't know what that rate is because, as we said, the present has already been determined by the future. That's a comfortable thought, isn't it? Everybody here is being pulled by that star, the infinite power of enlightenment. That's a fact. This entire audience is being pulled here because they're destined for enlightenment resistance. Isn't that amazing? That's a knowingness that I never checked it with calibration. Otherwise, there'd be no reason to be here. How to be a glider pilot, unless you're going to fly gliders, you wouldn't be learning on how to be a glider pilot, would you? And the spiritual work is quite strenuous. It's quite difficult at times. It's very uplifting. The overall context is uplifting. But then what that pulls up into the direct focus of your awareness can be sometimes painful and difficult and bring up temporarily guilt and negative feelings. Don't forget that our consciousness evolved over the ages, over the eons, came up through, as far as we can trace it, up through the animal world, the reptilian world, on up through the mammalian. And what you pull up out of the unconscious then, you can spot where its origin was back in time and stop beating yourself up with guilt. Jealousy arose long before you hit this planet. You can watch any monkey colony, and that's you'll see jealousy right and left. This is mine, this is mine. Fighting for the alpha male position, the alpha female position, joining up in groups, this group, us against them. Once you see its origin, then you stop attacking yourself. It's not personal. It's part of the one's karmic inheritance as a human being. Is to inherit that configuration of instinctual reflexes that we call ego, but they're really animal instincts. Everything about the ego you can spot in the animal kingdom, and you can see where it arose, with the exception of quantum mechanics, which did not arise in the animal kingdom. Now, we beat them out there, didn't we? Take that, monkeys and zebras. And we had fun calibrating on our various animals, and zebras and kangaroos, and it's very, so it's a lot of fun to calibrate the energy field of all these animals. And what was the one we did with the long necks? Giraffes. Didn't we say giraffes were 170? Giraffes were 170, 175. Giraffes are 170. Isn't that interesting? That's higher than a lot of people on the planet, isn't it? You're better off being a giraffe. I mean, you wander around there and you eat from the trees and you mind your own business. And a giraffe doesn't give you a problem unless you start attacking them. And if you attack a giraffe, he'll give you a whop with his hoof and send you flying. So that's a pretty good, nice way to be. You just wander around eating from the trees and you don't bother anybody unless they try to, unless a lion, the lion has a hard time with a giraffe because the giraffe's really going to get annoyed by a lion. So. But it's interesting just to calibrate different groups of animals because you're seeing and you begin to recognize in yourself where that all came from. Within you is the happy vegetarian who just liked to munch from the trees and not be bothered with people. In you is also the tiger. You push me far enough and and you're going to pull out my claws. So you see the origin of all that. And seeing the origin of it then removes it from a personal identification. You realize it's the source of the consciousness, which you now call me, but its origin, you did not devise that. Lions were around. Saber-tooth tiger was around before you got here. Yeah.
Do we have spiritual buddies that we
tend
to hang out with?
What does everybody think about that?
Yes.
Everybody think so? We all got spiritual pals we've been hanging out with probably for lifetimes. And let's see, we'll ask. We got people with whom we're spiritually aligned for lifetimes, resist. Simpatico, buddies like friends. We're all in the boat together kind of thing. Yeah. We're all in the boat together. Yeah, and quite a few of us are here right now. Yeah. Yeah, we're hanging out together. I mean, let's see. A lot of us are hanging out together here. Over 50%, 60%, 70%, 75%. Almost three quarters of us have been hanging out together for really quite a long time. That's an expression of our love for each other. You see, the love for each other creates the field, and then we're attracted to reincarnate in that field. Because in a way, we're sort of evolving with the field. You know what I'm saying?
Question always comes up about soulmates in relationships, marriages, whatever.
I don't know really what that means, a soulmate. I don't know if it's a legitimate question or a romantic fantasy.
That's why I asked you.
I don't know what soulmate really means. Well, there can be a commitment between two people that transcends reincarnations resist, can extend over many lifetimes. Yeah, there can be a commitment between people that extends over many lifetimes. And often when you run into them again in this lifetime, you feel a state of great joy, you know, you feel a flash, like recognition. Not conscious, it just comes up of its own, like a feeling of joy, just a spontaneous feeling of joy, of mutual recognition, yeah. Yeah, right? Right. Were you going to ask something?
David, I want to make a commitment for next year and coming back here. Are you going to be here? Are we going to meet again? Like a program that I can plan to come back?
Well, we're working on a schedule for next year. We thought that once a month is too hard and ourselves creating a lunch takes trucks of stuff. We thought maybe we'd make it a little shorter, the day a little shorter, have maybe a continental breakfast, what do you call it by other companies?
Catered,
yeah. Sort of like a breakfast brunch kind of thing, catered. Make the day a little bit shorter, not have so many group questions that may be more personal, where we spend more time talking with each other on a personal level, asking personal questions. Some of us could group around, well, a person asks a question, and we all search out how to find the answer to that, use each other for kinesiology, more than just a didactic lecture. Let's see, we just asked this again recently because in the final correction of the chapter, I went over the numbers again. You don't remember, Sonia, do you? No. We'll ask again. Well, I know I am getting tired. I remember.
I think you've got to quit.
Okay. We can ask just this one question about people over 700. No. We'll leave that for another time. It's in the book anyway. It's in the book, but we did go back over the figures because they had changed because, oh yes, there was one question I wanted to answer, and then we're going to have to quit. The consciousness level of mankind, I have permission to ask a friend of this audience who says, is now over 206, 207, 208, 209, 208. Since I did, it was 205, right? It went up to 207. Anyway, in the last year or two, it has gone up from 207 to 208. Somebody mentioned they felt a shift of consciousness, and we had already detected that. You know, the spiritual work you do on the nature of consciousness itself, don't forget you're affecting context, not content. See, spiritual work designed to affect content is limited in its power. Spiritual work designed to advance the field of consciousness itself lifts all the fish in the bowl. You understand what I'm saying? You're just trying to affect specific fish. So a lot of spiritual work, prayer groups and all, are very well intentioned, but they really don't impinge what's happening in the world because they're too localized. You know, we're going to pray for peace in Persia or something, you know, that's very localized, very limited. To work towards the advancement of consciousness itself, you know, lifts the whole game. And then whatever content is going on is lifted by the fact that the whole game is being lifted. I think if you just sit around praying all day for peace in Palestine or something, you're probably wasting your time. First of all, they don't want it. It's a fact, is it? Right. No, the payoff from hatred and being victim and martyr and getting even and revenge and all, it's a fierce game. And it's very hard to pull out of it. It's very hard to pull out of it. And the viciousness is that the one side sets up the other side, sets them up in such a way that they can't pull out of it. After you've victimized enough children from this side, how are they going to get out not avenging a whole school of children purposely destroyed? So what you do is you trap the other side into have to come back at me. You know what I'm saying? It's really vicious because it's poisoning the well. And there is a purposeful intention to prevent anything like peace from arising and being taken seriously. You create enough horror and hatred on the other, you make sure the other side hates you enough. That's really a lower astral trick, to make sure that sufficient hatred has been engendered to ensure the ongoingness of the conflict.
Well, are there any examples in history that where that condition has existed and some sort of an intervention has changed it that you know of, and what might that have been? I mean, I know that's
I don't know. All I know is we can track the level of consciousness of mankind as a whole throughout time. And if we had enough study groups, we could do it continent by continent, country by country, culture by culture, and see where it made major changes, and then go back in history and ask which of these things had an effect. It isn't a cause and necessarily cause and effect. It's a matter that certain conditions favor certain moves. See? So instead of causality, what you see is that certain conditions are favorable to certain potentialities. The quantum potentiality is favored. So rain and sunshine doesn't cause the plant to grow. but it increases the potentiality and the likelihood that the germination will be successful under these conditions. But you see, a plant is not caused to grow by sunlight. It's not caused to grow by light or caused to grow by moisture. Those are only the conditions which increase the statistical probability of a certain response. So you don't see cause and effect. What you see is potentiation of likelihoods. Rain and sunshine increases the likelihood that the potentiality of growing into a flower will eventuate into an actuality. So instead of cause and effect, what you see are conditions and likelihoods and statistical probabilities. You don't see cause and effect. Yeah? Cause and effect is an imagination that you try to project on because you don't really see what's going on. Mm-hmm. You wish, huh? I don't know if it's an answerable question. Are we the only humans in the universe? You realize there's an infinite number of universes which are being created at an infinite rate of speed continuously throughout all eternity. You realize that? You still want to ask the question?
Talking about other realities.
Huh?
Okay, because you talk about the lower astral. Yeah. All infinite number of astrals. Some might be higher, some you.
Yeah, well, we don't care about astrals. All we want to know is not to go there. There's an infinite number of universes expanding and being created at an infinite rate faster than the speed of light. Everybody thinks within the speed of light. No. There's an infinite number of universes which are created continuously at a rate faster than the speed of light exists. Yeah. See, the speed of light is just a human invention. Faster than the speed of light, there's an infinite number of universes. That which is God is present in all that exists. The divinity that all exists in all that exists is itself, has the essence of creativity. That which God creates has within itself the quality of divinity, which in and of itself then manifests as the evolution of an ever unending universe of universes. Infinite galaxies, infinite universes are expanding and coming out of creation continuously. Through an infinite number of dimensions. Even from advanced theoretical physics, advanced mathematics, you realize with a one square inch cube, there are an infinite number of planes, infinite number of dimensions within one cubic inch. Therefore, in an infinite series of infinite potentialities, the likelihood that we're the only ones who can think and feel, go to the bathroom, go to bashes is unlikely, you know what I mean? But we will ask the question.
All right, we'll close it off. All right.
Okay, it's... The answer is there's an infinite number of dimensions and infinite number of potentialities for consciousness such as our own to grow, you know. The answer is infinite, yes.
Okay, close it.
All right, so we will close up in the usual way. We'll have, I'd like to have that, Karen? Where's Karen? I'd like to end up back where we were, before we got off into the mind and all its propositions. So you have that mantra? Yeah? Everybody likes that one. After you hear it enough times, it goes on its own within, whenever you wish it to be there. And it's often very useful because it takes you back into an energy at 740, the feelingness of like the Greek cathedral, the exquisite beauty of nature, the divinity of all creatures as created. It's more like it takes you into the memory of that reality, and that sort of pulls you out of the crisis that you're currently upset about. One just experiences the availability and the reality of that field of energy. So it isn't the content of the mantra, whatever it's saying. It's the energy behind it. The essence of devotion itself. The sensitivity to exquisite beauty. The divinity of all that exists. Surrender your life itself. Not what you think is your life, this physicality, but the actual core of life itself. It's like we intuit where that space is. There's no book that can tell us how to get there. All the discussions we have are to clear away the obstructions. And then the light begins to like rise in the background and we get the space of where all that takes place. Mm-hmm. And our willingness to go there is our commitment to each other as a devotional group. Our willingness to go there for ourselves and for each other. Mm-hmm. Out of our love for each other. Which is not different than our love for God. So, I thank you for being here today, sharing this. God bless you all.